Understanding Lines and Variance Searches with Hess. So my talk will be divided into these sections. First, I'm going to introduce the subject, and this time we will see the experimentalist point of view on this problem. So I will describe the formalism we use in such studies. I will give a short word on the intrinsic effects. So as you have pointed out, we have time lags that are due to the source and not to the propagation. So we have to deal with them in some way or another. And so I will summarize what we try to do in the next section. After that, I will give a brief introduction about ground-based gamma-ray astronomy. Maybe all of you are not really familiar with this way of detecting gamma rays, high-energy gamma rays. And we'll talk about the detector we used, or we still use, to study this, HESS-1. And I will describe then in some details the HESS results concerning Lorentz invariance violation. These searchers use the same data set, which is due to the enormous flare of PKS1155-304 of July 2006. I will say why these data is really exceptional and why we are still use it now, more 6 years after the fact. I will describe the results, which were published in two publications, so you have the references there, one in 2008, one in 2011. Of course, these two publications are different in the sense that they use different methods to determine the time lags and to give the limits on the Lorentz invariance energy scales. Then I will come to conclusion and discuss a little bit the future developments in this field. So I'm going to give this introduction about what we try to do with astrophysical sources, but I have to point out that on Wednesday, Jonathan will give another talk concerning astrophysical sources. And so you will learn more also on this occasion. Sorry. Okay, so what we try to do is test these kind of relation, this kind of dispersion relation, giving the speed of light, the speed of the photons, as a function of speed, of, as a function of the speed of light, with an expansion with the energy of the photons. Here I stop at the second order, with the quadratic term. That's the term that we can give constraints that are not too weak, but you will see that we are far from being constraining on this term. And so the big message for us experimentalists is that the photons travel with different speeds, and the speed of the photons depend on the energy. So what we are going to try to do is measure time delays between photons with some assumption on how they were emitted. So Giovanni Amelino Camilla pointed out some time ago that these modifications in the speed of light, the speed of the photons, even if it's tiny, should add up on very large distances. So that's why you use cosmological distance sources like GRBs, AGN, preferably for this kind of study. And as we need to measure time delays, we need transient events, we need viable sources. So that gives us with two solutions, GRBs. So Jonathan will go back to this in his talk. We'll talk about Fermi results, I guess, and AGN flares. So for this, we need to use this formalism. So we have to express the time delay between two photons for which the energy difference is delta E. And so you get these kind of expressions for the first order, for the second order. So you see that you have one term here which takes the redshift into account. And this is simply due to the fact that two photons traveling traveling through space to the detector, if they don't spend the same time during the propagation, they won't see the same expansion of the universe. So you have this small correction to apply, taking into account this expansion. So basically what we are going to do is try to place constraints on the what we call the Langevin energy scale using photons from astrophysical sources. And here is the sketch of what's happening, or what we hope is happening. The source emits different photons, two photons at the same time, and they travel at different speeds, so they arrive at different times at the observer. So this is time here on the y-axis. So this is the quantum gravity effect, the Lorentz invariance violation effect. That's what we are looking for, and that's the propagation effect. The problem is that for all sources we use TRBs, AGNs, then we are not quite sure that all the photons, or I should say, we are sure that photons emitted at different energies most probably are not emitted at the same time. So I will get back to this a little bit later. But you can imagine that at the source, the photons of different energies are not emitted at the same time, and there is no propagation effect, so that you still detect them with a lag. So that's an emission phenomena we call source effect or intrinsic effect. So we need to separate the two effects, and the probably the best solution to do this would be to have population studies. So we start to do this with GRBs, with tens of GRBs we observed, but with AGNs then it's a little bit more complicated, because for AGNs we need that they flare, they give significant flux increase, and that will give the time structures we'll use later to measure the time delays. So the message is we need flaring AGNs. Okay, now as we don't know exactly what are the source effects, how they work, because we lack of a proper modelization of the sources, then we have to neglect the source effect. So this is quite an assumption, but here we try to reduce the effect of this assumption considering only one source of data. So for instance, here I will talk about Hess data. So for example, we are not going to mix the data from Hess and from infrared or X experiments. So we are going to stick into one wavelength array, here hard gamma rays. And that ensure in principle that all the photons are emitted with the same process at the source, and here in particular for Hess, so these are the data points for Hess with the energy in X and the flux in Y. And here we are in the inverse Compton regime, meaning that all the photons we detect are emitted by the same process, which is inverse Compton. So we are going to focus on this data, and we'll consider that the source effect can be neglected within these assumptions. Of course, here we are safe because no significant lag is measured. But if one day we measure a significant lag, then we'll have to go deeper in these explanations, trying to give a precise idea of when the photons were emitted at which at the source. So for the moment, it's not a problem. We don't measure any lag, any significant lag.
I think there was a claim of a lag some years ago.
So?
There was a claim of a lag some years ago.
By Magic, yes. On but they sometime after they just withdraw a little bit of this conclusion and they produce a limit. So yes and no. Okay, so
isn't
to,
isn't it possible that the source effect actually makes the lag smaller, brings lag to zero? So they just work in opposite direction?
Yeah, so it's still possible, so you're right, it's still possible that the source effects are in the opposite direction as the Lorentz invariance violation effects. But in that case, that would mean that we have the luck, or we are completely unlucky, that this effect compensates exactly the propagation effect. So this would be a conspiracy scenario, so we consider that not the case, simply. But it could be the case, yeah. But we cannot say. So for the moment, we just
we've got this. Even in the same source, different spikes typically have order unity difference in their lags. The propagation effects are identical for the same source, but it cancels out for one spike, including for others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Situation is rather complicated. As long as we are talking about the real data with the real sources, it's always difficult. So we try to adapt. We try to make reasonable assumptions about what happens at the source, and then we go on. So, as a summary for this first section, then to summarize, I will just say that we consider sources that are viable because we need to measure time delay. So we like to have spikes in the light curves, and we like distant sources because we think that this propagation effect would be larger if the source is at greater distance. So lately, the Veritas experiment started to talk about using pulsars to do this. So pulsars are galactic, so the source is much closer, but they somehow compensate this lack of distance by a greater precision on time measurement that they can achieve with a millisecond pulsar. So this is an interesting way. And Jonathan will mention this in his talk, I don't know. But I won't go much further on this. Okay, as I said, we consider an energy domain where only one emission process is thought to dominate. This is to prevent the effects from the intrinsic source lags. And all the remaining intrinsic effects are neglected. And so we compare either two light curves obtained in two different energy domains. So that's one approach, which was followed in the publication of 2008. And the other approach is to use individual photons, time, and energies with to compare these photons with a template at low energy. So this is the likelihood approach, which was used on our last paper. So now, I'm going to give a little bit of information about the principle of ground-based gamma ray detection. So the principle is given on this little sketch. We have a gamma ray which hits the atmosphere, so it will interact and give electron positron shower, basically. The charged particles in this shower will give Cherenkov light. So the Cherenkov light will be distributed as a cone like this, as a ring actually at the ground. And we detect this Cherenkov light with basically optical telescopes, but on which the camera is excessively rapid, the electronics is ultra fast, and we make pictures of these showers through the Cherenkov radiation. So here you have two examples of what we can get. So this is for hadron. So you see that the shape is rather irregular. For hadrons, you can have also muon rings. You can have really clear features. And here a gamma ray, which gives a shape which is much more regular. And we used to compare this shape with an ellipse to get back to the parameters of the incident camera. So I say fast camera, the camera takes such a picture in 10 nanoseconds, actually 15 nanoseconds, but the Cherenkov flash is about 10 nanoseconds long, depending on the incident angle of the shower. And it's very sensitive, made of photomultiplier tube, because the chunk of light flash is very faint. So once we have these images, we can analyze the images to get back to the to the type of the particle. So that's simply given by the shape. So this is much more ellipsoid than this one. The intensity, the content of the pixels give us the energy, and the orientation of the shower, so this is this direction, give us the source direction in the sky. Now with HESS, we have four telescopes, and this is simply to use the stereoscopy, meaning that with four telescopes, you can get a picture of the same shower from four different point of view. And with this, you can obtain a really higher angular resolution and discrimination power than with only one telescope. So basically, we just overimposed the four images to get the location of the source with much higher precision. So HESS is not the only one telescope working with this technique. You have Veritas in the US, MAGIC in the Canary Island. What I mentioned, just tactic, it's not exactly the same energy range than the three other observatories or detectors. And S is located in Namibia, in the Comas district, not far from the capital Windhoek, at 1,800 meters above sea level. So here's a picture of HESS. It's quite an old picture because the new telescope HESS 2 is not even being constructed. HESS 1 is operating, has been operating since 2002. So that's this year was the 10th year of operation of HESS. And HESS consists in four 15-meter diameter telescopes located on the coins of a square of 120 meters of size. The field of view with the camera, so the camera is located here at the focal point, is about 5 degrees, a very good angular resolution, energy resolution of 15%, and the typical energy range is 100 GV to 100 TV. It depends on the conditions of observations. And for the moment, we are more than 60 sources discovered, and this number is still growing. So I will go back to the future of HESS later, but now I'm going to talk about the HESS results. And for the moment, the HESS results concerning Lorentz invariance violation use the same data. And this data is described on this slide. We had the very good fortune to observe this BL-like object, so an NGN, PKS2155-304, in very good conditions, so very high in the sky. So when the source is very high in the sky, you have less fluctuations due to the atmosphere. You have less attenuation due to the atmosphere, so your data is globally of a better quality. So this BLISAR is at redshift 0.11, and we detected so this flare in July 2006, which is illustrated here with this light curve that you probably already saw. So in terms of flux, sorry, it's a very high flux, 14 crab, 10,000 photons in about half an hour and a half, 90 minutes. That means about 2 photons per second, which is extremely high for this kind of experiments. And so, as you see, a very high variability. We have 5 here identified spikes in the data, and we have rise and fall times of about 200 seconds. So this is really ideal data for looking for Lorentz invariance violation, and that's why we really studied it in depth to get the best limits as possible. So what makes this ideal data is the low the zenith angle. As I say, this is extremely important for ground-based gamma astronomy. Low energy threshold. So basically, we have an effective threshold of 200 GeV for this set of this set, which is quite good. And a negligible hadron contamination due to the flux of gamma rays. We consider that the background consists of less than 1% of the data, so it's just really negligible at our at all level. So it's really really clean data. Okay, I didn't mention that here you see the spectrum with a broken parallel with 3.53 as the spectral index in the right part. And we'll come back to this later. Okay, so now I'm going to show the results published in the two different papers. The main difference being the methods that we use to determine the time lags. So the first paper was using rather standard analysis techniques on bent light curves, meaning that you take your list of photons with time and energy and you make histograms for the time and you get the light curves. So here I show the two light curves obtained with the data in two different energy bands, 200 to 800 GeV, and the second is more than 800 GeV. And basically what these two methods do is that they identify, well, that's more the continuous wavelet. This method identifies the spikes and then tries, and then it's possible to compute the time lag simply taking the difference of the time between this energy band and this energy band. So for the cross correlation, it's direct because you take these two histograms, you put it into your cross correlation function, and then you get directly the result. So basically, this cross correlation method result is shown here. So you see the points as a gray shaded area, and then a fit of this maximum with a Gaussian plus a constant, which was used. The fit was used to locate the maxima, and the maxima gives you the lag you have between your two sets of data. So for this, the cross correlation function, we use two energy bands. The energy bands are shown in the light curves in the previous slide, from 200 to 800 GeV and more than 800 GeV. So that means that the delta E is about 1 GeV. And as I said, this is fitted with a Gaussian plus polynomial. And we find a lag of about 20 seconds with this method. So it's always important when you are studying a set of data to use different analysis techniques to hopefully try to probe different aspects of the light curves. And in this paper, we used another method, which is the continuous wavelet transform, which was used to locate the extrema in the two energy bands. Actually, the energy bands which were used for the continuous wavelet transform method are not exactly the same as the energy bands for the MCCF. So you have the values here. The delta is a little bit smaller. And here what you do is that you take the two light curves that I shown and you locate with the CWT, you locate the extrema in the two energy bands. And once you have located the extrema, you try to associate one extrema in this band with one extrema in this band. So here it could be easier. It could be easy. You can do it by eye. But for the others, it's a little bit more complicated. So you use criteria to ensure that one extrema in one energy band is really associated with another extrema in the other band. So you still have some uncertainty, but you take these uncertainties into account in your final result. Okay, so with this method, we measure a mean lag. So that's the average lag computed with all the pairs of extrema you extracted from low and high energy bands. And we found 27 seconds.
What is the error in this number?
Here.
But it's 20 seconds and 27 seconds.
So no, okay, so I will. Minus, yeah. No, of course, as you pointed out, so the results are not exactly the same, but the light curves we consider for the two approaches are not the same also. You see, the energy bands which were considered are not exactly the same.
I just want to know what's the error bar for this number.
Well, let me go back to it later because that's precisely the point of the next slide.
Another question. You say it's a delay. Which photon was fast? Which set of gamma rays was faster? The blue or the red? Or the high energy or the low energy?
Well, good question. I don't really remember. I guess that's the high energy photons that came first. Well, yeah, I think. If I remember correctly.
Show us the slide again. Maybe we can guess.
This one?
Yeah. The first peak is easy. We're gonna see it.
Well, it's not so easy, right? Soft first, okay. Well, here it's maybe it's. Well, no, okay. You can have a detailed look on this later. Okay, so now to understand really how the time lag determination works, in this work and also in the next one I'm going to talk later, we used time Monte Carlo really to get down too deep into the details of how the method works. And this is really important because at the end it's used to determine the error on our results and the limits. So we use the time Monte Carlo to simulate sets of photons simulating the light curves. So we simulated 10,000 light curves for each energy band. Of course, we simulate this as realistically as possible, meaning that we take the data as a starting point and we generate the set of photons following the distributions obtained with the data. So we varied the flux with the measurement errors that are the measurements, the error bars on the light curves. And we can compute the MCCF for each of these sets. And we measured the distribution, or we plotted the distribution of the maximum of the MCCF for each one of the simulations. And here you find that the maximum is about at 20 seconds, which is the result we found on the data. But we saw that in 21% of the realization, then a negative lag was not, a negative lag was found. So this result comes from the simulations and give us a mean of this distribution of about 25. You see that it's slightly on the right of the 20 second value found for the data. And the RMS, the width of distribution, is 28 seconds. Okay, so the once we had this, then we just said that the value 0 cannot be excluded, and that's why we set limits at the end. The second test that we can do really easily with the Toy Monte Carlo software is that you can inject a dispersion in the data. So you can consider that, for example, you have 50 seconds per TV, and you inject in your data this lag, and you test that your method is able to reconstruct the lag that you injected. So that's the purpose of this plot. You see the injected dispersion, the injected lag in seconds per TV on the x-axis. And here you see the result obtained as distributions like this, obtained with the MCCF method. And you see that actually up to, let's say, 50 seconds per TV, which is quite a large value, then everything is linear and on the identity, line. And you start to have problems only with very large values for the lags, and which this is related mainly to side effects. When the lag is too large, then it goes out of your time interval that you consider for the computation, and then you reconstruct only a fraction of the injected lag. Okay. The same kind of procedure was followed for the wavelet transfer based method.
Isn't there something strange with the last graph? Because if the uncertainties are as big as they are plotted, then the middle point shouldn't follow the line so well.
Sorry, I didn't get.
If the uncertainties in the measurement, your error bars, each one of the measurements, as big as the error bar, as you have pointed out there.
Here?
Isn't it strange that the straight line goes so well to the central point?
I don't really get the point.
Normally, it should be dispersion.
Okay.
The data should disperse according to your error bar.
He says there's no scatter.
Well, no, it's really. You know, for each one of these points, you obtain a distribution like this, which is Gaussian. So the point here is just the mean of this distribution.
Okay, then you have not scaled down the errors by the 1 over n.
Well, probably, yeah.
Or something like that.
This, I cannot guarantee exactly which value was used for this. It seems to be at least a factor of two high. I guess that it's not the standard 68% value they used, probably 2 sigma. Okay. So once you have measured your lag and measure or estimate the error on this lag using your time Monte Carlo, you can get the limits. So these are the upper values for the lags obtained with the two methods, so cross correlation and wavelets, and the corresponding limits. So we set the limits on the energy scale on which these effects would tend to appear. So that's a limit in GeV. And the results at that time were that we had a 7.2 times to the 17 GeV, so to compare to the Planck length, basically. And for the quadratic term, 1.4, 10 to the 9 GeV. What you can see from this table is that, and I've discussed this already, as the MCCF and the CWT approaches were made really independently using different energy bands, then you cannot expect to have exactly the same results. And that explains the difference in the limits here. So, well,
MQ quantum gravity, where the mass scale suppressing the dispersion relation, which
L is for the linear term when we consider only the linear effect in the dispersion relation. Sorry.
Cube over M or the P over M. So it would be pulling out the P square. It would be the P over M term.
Yeah.
And then the other one is the P square over M.
Yeah. Okay, and as you see, we have a low sensitivity to the quadratic term, and this is still the case with the new results I'm going to show right now. So, what's changed? There are several things that changed for these new set of results. The first thing that changed is the method. So, if we use a likelihood approach, so we study the correlation between the arrival time and energies of individual photons, and we follow the method used in Lamontal for integral GRBs and by Martinez and Arundo 4Magic Mark Iron 501 flare. And so this is the PDF. There are different ingredients, the acceptance of the detector, parameterization of the energy distribution. This term is, takes into account the energy resolution, basically. And this is a parameterization of the light curve taken at the source. So considered with no lag. That's the important message. Okay, so once we have here providing a proper normalization, then we get the likelihood function with the product of all photons, and we just find the maximum to get the reconstructed value for the linear and quadratic terms. So I said that we need two ingredients, basically two ingredients. A parameterization of the light curve, which I called FS in the previous slide. This parameterization of the light curve is supposed to have no lag included. So that's why we take the low energy light curve parameterization. At low energies, we consider that the lag is negligible. So we consider here an interval of energy between 250 GeV and 280 GeV. And so we parameterize this time distribution. So doing this, we used a peak finding algorithm to locate the extrema. It happens that this method found five peaks, as we saw in the previous data I shown. And we parameterized this light curve with the sum of five asymmetric Gaussian curves. Asymmetric Gaussian because you define it's a Gaussian, but you define separately the width at the right and at the left of the peak. Okay, the other ingredient is a parameterization of the spectra, so of the energy distribution. So here you can see that the data with this set follows a perfect power law from 250 GeV to almost 40 GeV. And then you have a question because at on the slide where I showed the data, there were a break in the power law. So it's really simple to explain because between these, this paper published first on the flare in 2006, and this data, the analysis techniques have improved. So applying the different analysis on the same raw data, then you can get slightly different lists of photons at the end. And that explains the difference in the spectrum that we see here. But it's really a small effect anyway. Okay, so once you include this into your likelihood computation, then you can do the job and plot. So the likelihood as a function of the parameter tau L for linear effect and tau Q for quadratic effect. And we find these curves. So the minimum is used to get the value of the lag. And here you could say that, well, basically you just have to look at the width of this parabola and use this value to get your error on the results and your limits at the end. And what we decided to do is not that, is that we decided to consider that this is one test. And with only one test, with one statistical test, then you can be lucky or unlucky. And instead of using this error that I quote here, we decided to gather errors from Monte Carlo simulations. So that's what we did. Using a toy Monte Carlo, so again, we simulated set of photons with the same statistics as the data, the same energy distribution, the same time distribution, or we use also...
Assuming that there is a Lorentz violation, or assuming that there is the Monte Carlo simulation was done.
So in the toy Monte Carlo, you can do whatever you want. So we injected a zero lag, so no lag, or we injected any value from minus 100 seconds per TV to 100 seconds per TV. This is what is shown on this plot, actually. using a very simple light curve of made up of only one Gaussian pulse. And you see here that the method is really precise at reconstructing the light that you inject. Okay, so the other important point about these time Monte Carlo simulations is that they can allow you to test all your systematics because you can tweak all the different parameters separately and have an idea of what impact they have on the data. So basically, one important information about these curves is not only the slope, but the slope is important, but as we are at zero lag, then it's the impact of this parameter is not so important. But the parameter which is important is the dispersion on the reconstructed lag. Okay, so what you can do with the distal Monte Carlo is consider only one Gaussian pulse and change its width. So that's what we did here. We changed the width of the Gaussian and we see how the error on the reconstructed lag vary. And this is a really important important result. Of course, the precision on the reconstructed lag decrease when the width of the light curve increase. On the right, you see the impact of the spectral index. So again, in the simulations, I can change the spectral index as I want. And so you see that the precision on the results will be better if you have a flat spectrum, which is to be expected, because if you have a flat spectrum, then you will have evenly distributed photons, which will be better for your final result. And now, what we can do is inject a parameterization in the Toy Monte Carlo software, which follows exactly the shape of the PKS155 light curve. And so that's what we did in the result. You see that it's not so good looking as if we inject or if we do only single Gaussian pulse for the light curves. But this is due to the high complexity of the PKS light curve. And for the linear model, we see this small shift.
You have 7 minutes.
7, okay. We see a small shift, okay. It's not zero when we inject a zero lag. So we included this into the errors computations at the end. And for the quadratic term, then it works quite well, except that we have this slope, which is not exactly one here. So you see that with complex data as PKS155, you have these kind of effects that can happen and that you can see when you use your Toy Monte Carlo software. On these, so simulating these PKS light curves in our Toy Monte Carlo, we extracted the value of these errors, which we take into account into the calculation of the energy scale at the end as statistical errors. Okay, what we can do also to estimate the error which is introduced when parameterizing the light curve at low energies, we can take this parameterization and make the parameters fluctuate into the error bars and see what happened. And actually, we are quite surprised to have such good results, because all these parameters in this parameterization of the light curve of PKS are somehow related. Because, for example, the width of one spike can have an influence on the location on the other spike in the parameterization. So when you do this, when you vary the parameters in the error bars, then you see that actually the dispersion is not so high or lower than you could expect. We have these values 7 seconds for TV, which is used, which is obtained simply with the width of this distribution, and 3 seconds per square TV for the quadratic term. Okay, so with this Toy Monte Carlo, we were able to test a lot of things, and we ended up with this summarizing table for the all the errors. There are some that I didn't discuss. Some are due to the analysis techniques, so extracting the gamma ray events from the raw data, basically. The spectral index, for example, is known with very good precision, as you saw from the fit I've shown. The calibration systematics are due to these reconstructed versus injected lag curves. And you have the last one I shown in the last in the previous slide about the parameterization, which is one of the biggest source of error in this kind of study. So we end up with these systematic errors that we take into account to the computation of the limits, and we get these values that are, for the Linear term, closer to the Planck scale, but not quite at the level of GRB studies by Fermi. And we have also this great improvement in the quadratic term. And these are actually the best limits obtained with an AGN so far, but I know that other experiments are fighting hard to get everything they can from their data. So I'm going to conclude now. I show here a picture which is the future of HESS, because you see the four you see the image of a gamma ray shower interacting in the atmosphere with the five telescopes of the new HESS system. So the four old telescopes and the new one. But before talking of S2 a little bit, I'm going to show this slide about the present results from AGNs. So the fact that the HESS result is more constraining is mainly due to the fact that we saw more photons in our PKS flare than MAGIC saw for their Markan 501 flare. Apart from this, PKS is farther, but that's the only thing you can say, basically. So we had luck with PKS 1155. We hope that we'll have luck again in the future, especially using this new telescope, HESS-2, which was inaugurated on the 20th of September this year. This is a big telescope. You have a 600 square meter reflector, a focal length of 36 meter, and the new camera is 2048 pixels. It was built in my laboratory in Paris. The goal of this is to lower the energy thresholds to 30 GeV. So we hope to see more transient sources with this system, and we definitely will have a look at all flaring sources in the southern sky. About gamma ray astronomy on the ground, then the future is CTA, Cherenkov Telescope Array. So this is the scale upper in performance, but also in money expenses. There will be three sizes of telescopes. There will be a challenging way to point the sources. Basically, when you have 100 telescopes, you can spend 25 telescopes pointing at source one, 25 telescopes pointing at another source in another direction. And which is really important for us is that you will have survey mode pointing, where all the telescopes will look at a slightly different shift at a slightly different position in the sky, so that you can do maps of a big part of the sky really quickly, and this will increase our chance to our probability to see transient events. So what we need for our future, okay, I'm done, that's my last slide. What we need is to focus on quadratic corrections. As you will see, Fermi results and our results in a lower extent tends to show that the Linear term in the dispersion relation will vanish anyway. We need to scan the distance and energy plane, and we need to use all different sources that we can to try to disentangle between propagation effect and source effects. Okay, so for this, we'll need population studies. So that's the goal of CTA. And with all these conditions, we expect to get new exciting results from the new exciting experiments coming in the near future. So thank you.
That's supposed to be done.
I didn't ask a question.
It was just enthusiasm.
I just want to comment that to disentangle between intrinsic and propagation dispersion is relevant only when you see dispersion. Currently, there's no claim for dispersion. So
yeah.
Maybe in the future, that's what you mean.
Yeah, yeah. I think I told it at the beginning. The source effects are important as soon as you have a detection of non-zero lag, let's say.
We should first try to detect some non-zero signal and then.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, I have a very simple question. If you had considered a logarithmic running in your dispersion relation, which in quantum theory we would also expect, for instance, how strong can you energy scale, because the running would be much less, much stronger, I guess, but in the heat space, and that's only logarithmic, you know, that I didn't correct, that's why it's so difficult.
Well, we didn't try.
Well, it will be something 1 minus some quantity divided by the Planck scale. So if that quantity is the ratio small, you can expand it in a power law and go back to the power law.
No, I don't think it's so simple.
You need to have the right infinite limit. So that log, if there is no Lorentz vibration, will be 0.
I mean, then
it's different. It's really different. The framework you're considering a renormalization of the NAS.
You use a log of this and then whether you can get some constraint which has some.
Yeah, but it's a log of some momentum dependent quantity. These are UV Lorentz breaking effect.
You can also break UV with the log of E over
right, E but then you need to have that the infrared part is the same. So it's going to be log of 1 plus some small ratio, but
maybe
then you expand
yes.
it.
Why not?
Okay.
What's the confidence level on your
what's the?
What's the confidence level?
That's 95. Sorry, 95%.
2.6.
Yeah.
So if I understood, you haven't ruled out a phenomenological model that most people, if people expected Lorentz violation, they would expect these m's to be of Planckian magnitude. And your bounds were somewhat below that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So far, it hasn't ruled out such a model, really.
With these tests.
With
this thing, which is much stronger than that.
Yeah.
Can
with these tests and with only one source, that's the only thing we can say.
Can I go back to your dispersion relation?
So how is the other? Can you just tell us what the other bounds are?
Well, the best constraint depends on which particle you're talking about. But on P cube over M linear dispersion relation, you are at 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8 for example. Well, it depends which constraint you prefer to use. But
you will see that Fermi results are at the level of excluding the linear effects. They reach the Planck scale, basically, with one GRBs. And this study will be completed.
That are not competitive. There are much better.
Yes, but they use different hypotheses. So
using the same hypothesis. Let me think. The point here is that here they are not using any hypothesis on the underlying dynamics because it's just the kinematics.
Right.
In fact, but you can get a better constraint than this, but you have to assume, for example, effective field theory.
Right, I understand.
Right.
That gives a much better
So, but all these constraints that are beyond this scale are assuming effective field theory, in a certain sense, because you are doing something like synchrotron radiation. You have to repeat the synchrotron radiation.
I thought it's a Fermi result.
The Fermi result is of the same kind.
Yes.
Right,
and is of the order of the Planck scale.
Yeah.
So it's just
right.
reaching the Planck scale.
Yeah.
Right.
Is that right? So these tests are particularly robust because they don't rely on the underlying theory. I have a comment regarding that. At least if you try to do the time delay in effective field theory, you see, you are I think you are putting plus or minus, but just because you are not assuming superluminal because of superluminal.
Yeah.
But in effective field theory, the linear term is going to be elicity dependent necessarily because that term is CPT violating. So what is happening is that you can have in a beam of light both fast, if it is not polarized, you have both fast photons and slow photons at the same energy. So basically, they do compensate and they do not lead to any time delay. So your constraint for the linear one has to assume that you're not in effective field theory. So if you are in effective field theory, you should look for a modulation in the intensity of the beam, a sinusoidal modulation. In fact, my question is that if you have looked for that,
we.
No, you should see that the beam, the intensity has a modulation which is related to the Lorentz violation. It's like a weaker effect, but it's there. If you have effective field theory and your beam is not does not contain just one polarization, but both, then basically the presence of the two polarization, one is low and the other is fast, because the opposite polarization of the photon have an opposite sign on front of that sign. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it would be interesting for you to look for this modulation, because that would be within the effective field theory what you have to look, not for the time delay, from the linear term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was this graph in which something was oscillating around its standard.
Oh, no.
No, but that.
This was the light curve. This one, for example?
Yeah.
So this is the light curve. This is the distribution of the arrival time of the photons.
Function of energy.
No. That's just the distribution of the arrival time.
Oh, okay. So this means
how many? Basically, it's counting photons
as
a function of time. There was a question by Lee.
Yeah, it was really for you, but since this is a discussion, how can you, if you're not sensitive to polarization, how can you see the fact that polarization claim that test the claim that polarization makes one go fast and one go the other go
Now, basically, when you try to construct PAD with the dimension 5 operator.
No, I know that.
Okay.
So I just want to know how you can see that.
So simply you don't assume it. The most natural assumption is that in this beam of light arriving from an AGN, there are both the polarization. You need to have some mechanism that.
How can he see that? You claim that he can see an effect even if his experiment is not sensitive to polarization.
No, but you can see an intensity. Basically, this fact that there are both the polarization, you can look at the intensity of the beam of light arriving to you, and you can show that this intensity has a modulation due to the Lorentz breaking. Exactly in the case in which.
Because of interference between the two polarizations?
Yes, basically. I would say that. So now, it's split. It's basically. But
the population splits a bit.
Because one is faster and then is slower.
So even though you're not sensitive to measuring what polarization is coming at you, okay, the actual intensity,
you see that these modulations
pulls apart from that initial signal over time. Mm-hmm. So there's a two-peak bump on your high-end alone, just to consider your high-end photons, your blue photons. You should see some sort of double peak if they're separated enough. If not, it's some spreading of the initial
spreading signal. Spreading is frequency dependent.
Right, exactly. The spreading would be frequency
right.
dependent. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, they don't know what the polarization is.
I see.
But they can still measure
it. You can see and you can measure an effect.
Yeah.
And there is another point. If you could be able to show that there are both the polarization, you can avoid all the problem of time of emission of the photons of different energy at different times. Because in that case, you look at photons of the same energy but with different polarization. And then you just look at the time delay between the two.
Okay, you're assuming that
you should be able
you're assuming that the generation mechanism does not depend on polarization.
Yes, but I think that is quite.
I think that
you can say that.
Can I just make one comment in regards to this? This whole discussion about EFT and kinematics and stuff. Because of this splitting, right, and the ways that the polarizations separate, right, so if you have a low frequency, one that comes with some basically the speed of light, right? The high frequency ones, the polarizations will be both faster and slower than the speed of light.
Right.
So one of the high frequency populations will arrive before the low frequency one, and the other population will arrive after.
Right.
So if they see a signal, okay, of just a low frequency population and then a high frequency one, and there's actual delay, it means not only that you have Lorentz violation, but you've lost effective field theory. Okay.
Well, it means you may have Lorentz modification, not violation.
Right, exactly, yeah. But right, what I'm saying is that this framework that most people are very used to using is just wrong.
Right.
Which to me is a much more significant statement than just saying, oh, we maybe have some other vector field or something.
No, sure, that's a signature of deformation.
Correct, right. Yeah,
exactly. So I was stressing that exactly because, you see, you have a way with these kind of things. If you see the signal, basically to disprove somehow.
It most likely means some intrinsic source of that, so really not to be careful.
Now, of course, so once you see the factor, you have to clean it up. You know that the photons of different energy are not emitted at the same time, most probably. Okay. Other questions?
Connected to. But also the relation that one uses in order to see the time delay should then change for the DSR, I mean, the relativistic picture. Because, I mean, what you're looking to is small redshift, so it doesn't make, so much difference. But in that case, what should you look for in the relation?
Yeah.
Right.
Basically, as an experimentalist, then I take what the theorists say, and if I'm
and about the modulation, for example, is something.
Yeah. Yeah. We are actually going to look at this. Yeah.
Me.
Yeah, so this is a related point. Could you comment or somebody comment on the difference between this, your kind of measurement and the Fermi kind of measurement with respect to being biased in favor of retardation or advance? The question that Raphael asked, does you seem to be not biased towards whether the higher energies go faster or go slower, whereas the Fermi kind of analysis is biased because it's much... There's a big difference between identifying the beginning of the burst versus identifying the end.
It depends which method. Some methods are not sensitive to that.
Good. So can you elaborate?
Okay. There, as opposed to these sources, which live many millions of years, GRB can last, tens of seconds or a fraction of a second. So it's a one-time event. So if you see even a single but significant high-energy photon, it's reasonable to assume it's associated with this one explosion and was not emitted intrinsically before the explosion went off. And in that case, we can constrain that the high energy photons propagate slower than the photons and not the other way around.
Right, so that way it's biased.
Yes, but there are other methods as well which are not. We can play similar games with spikes which are not smeared off, whether you see dispersion and so on with a large number of photons. So those methods are not the methods using one energy photon instead.
And so do they agree? Like, the question that which one arrived first, the high energy or the low energy?
Mm-hmm.
Claim
no
signal.
What? As far as
no signal, apparently there is no significance in
that.
Yeah,
but
there's one way or the other way, we see no significance difference.
Deeper.
We have only limits. Don't claim detection.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the limits, let's say. Which one?
that's a fair question.
What is the tendency?
From a simple analysis, our limits were roughly symmetric.
So one is excluded, right? I'm asking which one is excluded.
Well, let's have a confidence interval around zero, right? So is the distance from zero in the negative or positive direction similar or not? That's the question.
But again,
sometimes the high energy photon comes first, sometimes it comes second. In the group of three, the highest energy photon comes in the middle.
Good. So basically, you cannot do that one. It's basically symmetric around zero.
Yeah,
so
but
one last question before the coffee break.
Well, another thing that can cause a dispersion relation would be a massive photon. So you should be able to re-express this easily as a limit on the mass of the photon. Can you say what that limit is?
No.
Well, we have already supported 10 to the minus 22, no?
What?
Is the mass of the photon with respect to the mass of the electron? 10 to the minus 22. So, I mean, we have already a very strong constraint on the photon.
10 to the minus 22 of the mass of the electron?
I'm trying to remember, and I think that the mass of the photon
cannot
be...
The effect of a mass, you don't go to high energy. It's so you don't use this study to look for the mass.
No, this wouldn't be the best bound.
It would not be the best
but
bound.
But I'm just wondering
it
what
it is a bound, yes,
bound.
But I don't think much effort went into it because it cannot compete with low energy bounds.
Right. Which in fact are very strong.
Which are much better strong.
Magnetic.